This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick.
We're entering a critical stage of our investigation. We've now taken the testimony of hundreds of witnesses with knowledge of the events of January 6th, including more than a dozen former Trump White House staff.
The House Select Committee investigating the insurrection has been on the case for the better part of a year. And just in the last week, we've learned that the White House call logs show a mysterious gap of 7 hours on January 6th. And a federal judge issued a major ruling in a case related to the committee's work in which he stated that President Trump likely committed a felony in attempting to obstruct Congress. The Select Committee itself has produced some stunning revelations already, but time is working against it. If the Republican Party gains control of the House in this year's midterm elections, as they're predicted to do, they're almost sure to dismantle the effort and take any idea of accountability off the table. To get a sense of what all this means, I called on two colleagues, Amy Davidson Sorkin, who writes regularly about politics, and Jeannie Sook Gerson, who covers legal issues and is a professor of law at Harvard. Jeannie, how would you describe the stakes of what the committee is trying to learn here? And who's listening?
I think that history is listening, and the stakes really are to piece together a narrative and to tell the true story of what happened. And that is the purpose of this investigation. But of course, we know that there are criminal charges going on and criminal indictments. We know that there are potential executive privilege cases being litigated in our courts, and also just paper documentary evidence and emails and things like that. And all of that is kind of coming together in this one large kind of explosion of potential accountability. And it's both important to parse those things as very separate legal phenomena, but at the same time, of course, they all are getting at the same thing, which is, what is the truth of what happened on January 6th? And that is exactly the question that is so central to the divisions in this country.
Amy, what do you think?
Some of the most important work the committee has done has been to litigate privilege claims, executive privilege, lawyer-client privilege, brought by former President Trump and his associates. One of the turning points in the committee's investigation into January 6th came this January, when the Supreme Court turned away a fairly outlandish privilege claim brought by President Trump to trying to block the release of documents from the National Archive. He lost 8-1. And some of those documents had been torn apart into little pieces and put back together by the National Archive. And in a way, that speaks to the work that the committee is doing, trying to tape back together something that's still being torn apart.
About 2 months ago, Jane Mayer published an extraordinary piece in The New Yorker about Ginny Thomas, wife of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, and her political activities, her relationships with far-right figures in Washington. And it was incredibly revealing, and it suggested that perhaps Supreme Court Justice Thomas was wrong in not recusing himself from various cases. Then comes the news that Ginny Thomas was texting with Mark Meadows, the White House Chief of Staff, and the the contents of those texts were quite remarkable. What jumped out at you about that recent reporting?
Well, what jumped out at me most strikingly was the fact that this wasn't just expression of opinion, you know, all of us text with friends to express our opinion at what's going on. This was really action, like it was urging Mark Meadows to do something to have the election results of 2020 overturned. Now, on the conversation about her relationship to her husband, Justice Thomas, I think that's a really interesting one on which I have some complicated feelings, because she is the spouse of a Supreme Court justice, and that's obviously why the story was so revealing and explosive and important, like her spousal relationship. She wasn't just any other activist in this space. Justice Thomas, of course, as Amy mentioned, has already made a decision as a Supreme Court justice on a very relevant case about January 6th, the one involving National Archives records. And so in that way, it does seem quite problematic, and it's very good that the public knows that this happened. Now, whether there are other steps that should be taken, like Thomas should now recuse himself from any case that could potentially come before the court, well, I don't know that that's really, I think we have to think carefully about that. Honestly, spouses, obviously, many of them have jobs, and sometimes they're two career couples, and sometimes there are people who are married.
We hear that on Fox News, especially lately, that the, you know, this town, meaning Washington, that deathless phrase, this town is filled with couples that have careers that overlap in some way politically, and this is just yet another one in the District of Columbia. Is it just yet another one, Amy?
Well, I think the middle ground, in terms of what Jeannie's talking about, between automatic recusal and shrugging and saying this is just how Washington's a strange place, is transparency. Is it possible for a Supreme Court justice to sit on January 6th cases after his wife has in texts, mind you, to the White House chief of staff, not just to anybody, expresses these extreme views? Let's talk about that, but let's talk about it. I think what's not a Hartford question for me is that it should be laid in front of the public. It's also telling, in terms of where the Republican Party is, that she wasn't just saying, let's try to do something. She was referring to conspiracy theories. It was quite extreme, and that's revealing, too.
Now, Jeannie, a federal judge recently ruled in a civil case that Trump had likely committed felonies in trying to overturn the election. The judge described Trump's plan as a, and this is quite a quote, a coup in search of a legal theory. Can you talk a little bit about the origins of that case and how it's significant?
Yes, this is the case of John Eastman. He is an attorney, a former law professor. He was an advisor to President Trump about the 2020 election. And he had a plan that he outlined for the Trump team as to how the election results could be overturned by having Vice President Mike Pence reject the election results. And so he was asked by the committee investigating to turn over documents. And he said no, because attorney-client work privilege and attorney work product is protected. And essentially, it is true that if, say you have an attorney and you commit a crime in the attorney's presence, like conspire to rob a bank, or you just conspire with the attorney to rob a bank, those are not going to be protected by attorney-client privilege. It's an exception called the crime fraud exception. And that I'm very heartened that this judge put this out there, that it's not simply just like, oh, here are some legal options that we can talk about. There is a line between advising your client about legal options and actually urging or advising people to do something that breaks the law.
So what can we say about the committee's tactics and strategies so far, Jeannie? Some have called them very aggressive, pointing out that the committee is using techniques often used by federal prosecutors against the mob, against the mafia. In what ways are they using similar tactics to how the mob was prosecuted? Is that at all fair?
It's fair in I mean, it's fair, but the characterization is fair, and also it is fair for the committee to use those techniques. Both sides are fair in the sense that, well, the mob is very difficult to investigate because they stick together and they don't kind of snitch on each other.
Well, they used to.
Right. So that's the difficulty, that you're facing a bunch of stonewalling. Now we've lived through years of stonewalling by Trump's associates in congressional investigations and otherwise. And so it is appropriate when you are dealing with people who are hostile to being investigated and not cooperative to then turn to techniques that are tried and true to get information. At the end of the day, this is about producing knowledge. And if in the process of producing knowledge through an investigation, they come up with some evidence that is criminal, evidence of criminal conduct, what are they supposed to do? Not refer to DOJ for investigation? That would be absurd.
Just in the last few days, there's been a development involving Mo Brooks, of all people, the Alabama congressman who was a full-on Stop the Steal, was endorsed by Trump in the Senate race there, and now has been unendorsed by Trump and has been talking about how Trump wanted him to rescind the election. He's heavily hinted that he might be willing to speak to the January 6th committee. And that's where you go back to the mob analogy. We're dealing here with people who are not the most restrained in their thinking and their actions and can be affected by delusions of grandeur. And people like that often fall out with each other. And when they do, it can be to the benefit of investigators and prosecutors, and we may find that it is now.
I want to ask you both a very broad question, and maybe the question that is on everybody's mind. Donald Trump was impeached twice, and he was not convicted in either case. And we knew that was going to happen because of the composition of the Senate. Now Alvin Bragg, the Manhattan DA, seems to be backing away from any criminal prosecution. And this committee, well, establishing a historical record, and that's important, is in danger of not having a criminal referral for Donald Trump. And time may run out on it completely because the midterm elections are fast upon us in November. So, Amy, do you think that Trump will get off in legal terms scot-free?
There's an important player in that question, and that's the Republican Party today. When we talk about the verdict of history, that matters. So in the shorter term, does the verdict of Republican primary voters who might be deciding whether they give him another shot? And they're influenced in that by Republican Party leaders. Are they shocked by what they're learning or by what they remember having been there on January 6th? What are they saying to their voters, to the people who've elected and trust them in many cases? You know, will he get away with it? What does getting away mean in this sense? Will he get away in terms of how we remember him, or in terms of what powers we're still willing to give him? That includes the power to influence the Republican Party, and it's within the reach of the Republican Party to have a say in that.
Jeannie, same question.
I think that the question of whether he is going to get away with it just cannot focus so much on criminal consequences for Donald Trump. They're just not synonymous. And so I already think that Donald Trump hasn't gotten away with it. Look at all of the different investigations that are affecting him in New York and in Congress and elsewhere. There are many different avenues for bringing things to light. And ultimately, he's not getting away with it if we bring to light the truth of what he did. That doesn't mean he's got to be criminally convicted, which is a very, very difficult thing to do in any event, and certainly of a former president. And it's not even clear that it's in our country's interests to have a former president be criminally convicted after he leaves office.
Why do you say that?
Because we are having these debates about accountability, but we also know that in this country, every move that the committee that's investigating January 6th, every time they do more to bring accountability, half of the country thinks this is illegitimate. And so it is not actually clear that having Trump being convicted of a crime is going to change that in a direction that is productive for the continuation of our democracy in a way that could possibly repair things.
I very much agree with Jeannie. We have ballot boxes. We have Election Day. And we have a problem with Trumpism, not just with Trump personally. There have been ideas thrown around about, oh, maybe if there's a conviction, maybe we could just disqualify him from running again. I strongly believe that that's not the answer. This has to be accomplished by democratic means. And ultimately, it has to be done on Election Day.
Amy Davidson Sorkin writes about politics for The New Yorker, and Jeannie Sook Gerson writes about the law. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour, with more to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. We need a better conversation about the latest biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-host cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, and snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.
This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. One of the very first stories that we aired on this program, episode 8, as a matter of fact, was about a man named Dick Conant, a kind of adventurer who in middle age began taking trips by canoe, long, extraordinary trips. Take one example. Conant traveled the entire length of the Mississippi River down to the Gulf of Mexico. Then he paddled back upstream on the Mobile River, making his way to Tennessee. Then he gets a ride over the peak of the Appalachians and finally paddles the James River through Virginia out to the Atlantic Ocean. That's just one trip. And by chance, Dick Conant met staff writer Ben McGrath one fine day on the Hudson River. 8 years later, Ben's book about Conant called Riverman, An American Odyssey, comes out this week. And so we wanted to revisit this story about a very difficult, troubled, but truly remarkable life.
So here, we're in the town of Piermont, New York, which is about 15 miles north of the George Washington Bridge on the west side of the Hudson River. And I like to go kayaking, usually in the mornings. And the day I met Dick, which was Labor Day of 2014, I was going to take my 2-year-old kayaking. And my neighbor peeked his head over that wall and he said, "There's somebody in here who I think you might want to meet." So I started walking over to my neighbor Scott's house, and you know, before heading inside, I notice at this point that there's this dirty red canoe tied up to the base of his seawall, it's covered in tarps and some trash bags maybe, and it's got army duffels. I mean, it really looked like it had been packed for the apocalypse. And inside, sitting at the head of a long rectangular table, was Dick Conant. He said he was 63, and he had a big beard, and he was bright red, and he probably weighed 300 pounds. He had these dusty denim bib overalls. I mean, I remember having the impression that it was as though Santa Claus had canoed into town. And he was kind of holding forth, and I gathered that he was about 2 months into a journey that he expected to last at least another six more months. And he had begun up by the Canadian border and was basically going to be taking a chain of rivers and canals down the Atlantic seaboard and ending up in Florida. And he was on this journey for, from what I could tell, no particular reason. It quickly became clear that this was not his first insane voyage. In fact, within a couple of minutes of my arriving, he was telling a story about how he once almost got run over by a barge on the Mississippi at night. As it happened, he'd basically been crisscrossing the country alone in a canoe for the better part of 2 decades. But I missed the opportunity to really draw him out on the particulars of those trips because I did, after all, have my 2-year-old with me, and he was threatening to destroy my neighbor's house. So it wasn't really until the next morning when I woke up and thought, okay, I gotta find this guy again. So I got some binoculars and drove down south. And after a while, sort of hiking along the shore, I was able to see off in the distance this flashing yellow plastic paddle. When he got within earshot of me, I yelled his name and started waving him ashore. And he backed the boat in, and he just decided to set up camp right there.
I'm due for a good break. I might make camp right here. I'm exhausted.
Right.
Is there a place not you can sit? Do you have something to drink, like a soda pop?
I don't, unfortunately. Sorry.
Would you like one?
No, I don't want to waste your supplies.
Yeah, it's no waste. Believe me.
And I started talking, and I began to learn the very long and mysterious life of Dick Conant.
I was born in Germany. We lived in Germany for 3 years. My dad was with Army Armor, so we moved down to Kentucky, Fort Knox, for 4 years.
But when I was a bit of an army brat. He'd been all over the place, but most of his schooling as a boy was done in Pearl River, New York. Pearl River is a pretty ordinary suburb now, but in the 50s and 60s when he was there, they did really think of it as kind of Mark Twain country. It was winding country roads, and the upper reaches of the Hackensack River were there, and they had a little dinghy, and they would kind of go up and down. Dick, in fact, invented a club that it was called Catfish Yacht Club. So there's a way in which, throughout all of his life, he saw himself as a kind of an epic adventurer. He was at the top of his high school class. He had a full scholarship to college. He was a hugely talented man who had, because of various troubles he had, not amounted to much in a conventional sense.
Maybe I had a really checkered career, what you call.
Right.
I worked on the railroad in Wyoming for about
He had worked
years.
On the railroad. In Wyoming, he had worked on the oil rigs. He was a coal miner. He was a janitor. He worked in hospitals. He was a weather observer. He was in the Navy. He worked selling, most recently, before I met him, he'd been selling bus tickets at a Greyhound station. So I think, you know, the fact that he hadn't achieved, and one of the phrases that he didn't have a white picket fence, he didn't have a family.
I'm at 63 years old.
Right.
You know, these adventures are incredible. They really are. However, I would much rather be at home with a woman.
Right.
And a family like you had.
Right. And he was homeless.
Well, one of the reasons I go on these trips is because, I don't have an apartment.
Okay. When he wasn't paddling, he camped outside in what he called a swamp in Bozeman, Montana.
People call it homeless. I don't. I've been living like this since 2007.
From talking to him, it was clear that he was extremely well-read, both in a historical sense with literary references and historical references, but also could more than hold his own when talking about current events.
You know, when this trip is over, I'll sit down and write a prose account.
He told me that he'd written several books, and in fact, I think had a couple of them with him in the boat on flash drives.
Well, I've written 3 books.
Oh, okay.
I'm just not published.
Okay.
By the time I get finished writing a book, I'm ready to go on another trip.
The books read like journals. Each of them is a chronological account of a particular transcontinental canoe trip.
November 13th, 1999. I visited with a dog. This damn thing followed me for 2 miles along the riverbank after I got underway. November 14th, 1999. I saw an interesting sight today. A bald eagle was pestering and chasing a great heron in midair. He ran him... August 12th, 2009. I'm up at dawn. I paddle all day. I see eagles and other wild... January 18th, 2010. I'm on a tawny sand beach listening to squawking birds. January 4th, 2000. My abode, my bedroom, is a gravel riverbank. And my living room is the greatest river system of the most beautiful country on earth. August 20th, 1999. Some guy and his wife woke me up from a nap at Lewis and Clark State Park. He asked me if that was my rig in the river. I said the red canoe was mine. He asked me where I was going. I said the Gulf of Mexico. He asked me, eventually, why? I told him I got tired of TV and automobiles, and so I just took off and jumped in the river. He and his wife stared at me blankly. Like Pat Schroeder used to say, some of you people just don't get it.
He was physically a very striking man, you know, very large, always wore overalls. He apparently rode a bike that was often too small for him. He had a kind of a booming, if gentle, voice. And in a town, in a place, you get a man who looks like that on land, and that person sticks out in a way that makes people uncomfortable. And he was very aware of that. Bozeman, Montana is a relatively small town where if you're a 300-pound man who wears overalls and rides a bicycle back and forth, people do know you and notice you again and again and probably do roll their eyes or whisper things. There's that guy on the bike again. When he's on the river and he emerges into a new town, he's not that guy, he's this guy. And the difference between that guy and this guy was everything to him.
September 17th, 2007. At the risk of sounding like a whining crybaby complainer, I've got to get some baggage off my shoulders. The people in Bozeman did not appreciate my talent or skills or, God forbid, my robust personality. I am not a wealthy man unless I consider the innate skills granted to me by nature. As this present odyssey can convey, I am an unabashed and gifted adventurer.
Because he'd been a successful kid and student and athlete and all these things, he had a strong sense of his own talents and potential. And yet by middle age, he clearly hadn't reached any of it, in a conventional sense at least. And so the canoeing, which really he took up, I think his first long trip, he was 43 years old. So in a way, you could think of it as a midlife crisis. But it also, it became a way for him to shift that sense of squandered potential into a real sense of accomplishment. It became a career in which he could excel.
September 17th, 2007. This is a good opportunity to reiterate a concept which is very real and quite stabilizing in the psychological aspect. Though I am no king of the Irish or any warrior king, when I am out on the water in my canoe, I do call the shots. My time is my own. It belongs to me. Though in most places I visit, I am treated with friendship and generosity and often kindness in the extreme, I am beholden to no one.
My main goal at the time had been simply to write a short talk of the town story for the magazine about an unusual man who had passed through town. And I think the story came out in late September. October 20th, he sent me an email saying that he was hale and hearty in Delaware City, Delaware. And at that point, I believe he said he was preparing for his next leg, which was across Chesapeake Bay, and didn't hear anything again until November 29th. It was a Saturday, and I was getting lunch ready for my kids. And I got a phone call from a number I did not recognize, and it was a wildlife officer in North Carolina saying he was investigating a missing boater. And it took me no more than 2 seconds to realize who he was talking about. As it turned out, some duck hunters had found a canoe, but not a canoeist. And in going through the boat, they had found my phone number in it. the point where they found the boat, it was turned upside down up against some cypress knees. And it was on the Albemarle Sound in North Carolina. And if you look south across the sound at that point, it's like 12 miles across. I mean, you can't see the other side. You might as well be on, you know, Lake Michigan. So they thought they had a huge search area, and they didn't know when he'd gone missing because no one, his itinerary was known only to himself. Dick had 7 living siblings. Not one of them knew where he was or what he was up to. If they knew, it was only because I'd written an article in the Talk of the Town section.
I wanted to visit my mother and siblings. Some of them I had not seen in over 25 years. If you don't visit once in a while, you end up forgetting altogether.
After he had gone missing, I went back to my notes and I saw the part in my conversation with him when he mentioned his older brother Joe in Peachtree City, Georgia. I looked up Joe's phone number at that point when I got the call from the officer, and I gave the officer Joe's phone number, and that's how the family found out. Unfortunately, you know, I think there was an initial wish on the part of friends he'd met and his family members to think, well, maybe he, you know, look, he lived a free and kind of untethered life to begin with. Maybe he just decided to ditch the boat and go somewhere else. The thing that makes that seem unlikely is that, you know, he already lived pretty close to off the grid. As much as he wanted to, he was able to accomplish it. You know, he lived outside in Bozeman, Montana. He paddled where he wanted to, when he wanted to. They found a mountain of stuff in his boat, his wallet, his naval discharge papers, his journals, his maps, his money, his food, his tent. His body is still not accounted for. They have been tracking his bank account since he went missing, and the only activity in his bank account is the monthly automatic deposit of his Social Security. It was a weird and almost unsettling feeling to think that sort of just by happenstance I'd become the link between Dick and his largely estranged family, and it felt very personal. A few months after the news had kind of had settled in, I ended up meeting with a couple of his brothers who lived closer to me, and they began sharing with me some of his manuscripts and talking to me about their childhood. One of the things that became clearer was that he was sensitive to an extreme and sometimes paranoid and delusional degree. In fact, when he was in the Navy in his 30s, he was briefly placed on mental leave. But I think the most elegant way of putting it is something Dick himself said to his mother, apparently, after he completed one of these trips. And that's that he told her that he'd been contending with mental barnacles.
March 31st, 2010. I am paranoid, so I spent some time camouflaging my camp. It is small and tight, but I'm getting paranoid. It looked like another setup. If I got friendly with one woman, the other would have reported. September 16th, 2009. One can never be certain of what another will do when he or she is truly afraid. March 5th, 2010. Now I am increasingly thinking that my visit had more sinister aspects to it than I... November 15th, 2007. I began to think in terms of the infinite variety of turns a human mind can twist to fabricate and mold. Given irrefutable facts, a determined mind can construct a total delusion out of a whole cloth and thereby satisfy a gnawing yet wishful thought process.
This is one of the reasons why he would often move, is I think he, ultimately, if he spent too many days in one place, he began to worry that he'd overstayed his welcome, and he felt that he had to go, which is a shame, because in many cases when I call the people who were there, they only remember him fondly. They don't remember the offending incident that made him think that he had to go.
December 20th, 2007. I began to feel like a heel when I finally empathized with him, with Wayne. The feeling that I had offended him and his friends began to gnaw at my mind. It will continue to do so for some time to come. I just frankly didn't know any better. My ignorance of social niceties this late in life is fairly deplorable, but I guess it comes with the territory. I find it a bit disconcerting that of the many friends I have met on this adventure, most I will never see again.
You know, when I look back at the talk story I wrote, I wonder sometimes, in light of what happened, about a comment that an old family friend of Dick's made. I think it was something like, you know, what Dickie needed was not an article in The New Yorker, but an intervention. I feel pretty strongly that isn't true. I really think, in light of what I've come to understand about his past and some of the difficulties he faced in his head, is that I really think that the rivers were a survival mechanism for him. And he himself would often write that he was surprised that he was still alive, and not because he'd been doing this crazy river paddling, but because of other things that had happened in his life. For Dick, it wasn't a lark. It was simply his way of being.
January 18th, 2008. Frankly, if somebody prefers the domestic life, that is the life he leads or pursues. If he prefers to wander, then he takes off. This stuff about finding oneself is a bunch of baloney. I repeat that I am not out here finding myself. I was never lost. What I am doing is paddling around, finding geography I have not seen, observing various industry and transport, experiencing wildlife, meeting new people, most of whom are worth meeting, and having a jolly good time before I die.
It was the only way that Dick could be happy in the world was moving along through a river. He himself seemed to think that when he first began doing this as a serious line of work, so to speak, which was more than 15 years ago, that was the beginning of saving his life rather than ending it.
Well, thank you so much.
Yeah.
I will find
you. I love telling about my trip. I don't care if I get published or not, you get published or not, but I do enjoy relating.
Yeah.
That's half the fun.
Are you be careful.
All right.
Drive safely.
Very good.
Best for your wife and child.
Will do.
One and the other.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah.
Will do.
Ben McGrath's book, Riverman, An American Odyssey, tells the story of Dick Conant, and it's published this week. Conant is still missing. Excerpts from his journals were read for us by Peter Gallagher. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs, because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. This week in our podcast, The Writer's Voice, Tessa Hadley reads her short story, After the Funeral, which was just published in The New Yorker.
After the funeral, the two little girls, aged 9 and 7, accompanied their grief-stricken mother home. Naturally, they were also grief-stricken, but then again, they hadn't known their father very well and hadn't enormously liked him. He was an airline pilot and they preferred it when he was away working. Being alert little girls, they'd picked up intimations that he preferred it too. This was in the 1970s when air travel was still considered glamorous. Philip Lyons had flown 747s across the Atlantic for BOAC until he died of a heart attack. Luckily, not while in the air, but on the ground, prosaically eating breakfast in a New York hotel room. the airline had flown him home free of charge.
You can read Tessa Hadley's After the Funeral and stories by some of the greatest fiction writers working today at NewYorker.com. Sheldon Pierce is the music writer and editor of the New Yorker's Goings On About Town section. So this guy is so immersed in music that where other critics write up a year-end top 10 list, Sheldon writes a top 30. So the Grammy Awards are a little bit vexed for Sheldon. Are you particularly into the Grammys? Is it a big night for you?
It used to be. I think there has been too much getting it wrong over the last 10, 12, 15 years that it really doesn't mean that much to me anymore. I sort of understand how it works as this thing that is trying to get a certain number of viewers on a Sunday night, and not really this thing that is aligned with the critical discourse or even really popular interest.
Now, the idea here is we're going to go to three categories and you're going to pluck one of the nominees out and get rid of it and put something new in that you think has been overlooked. Does that sound good to you?
Right. There's an outlier normally in every single category that just feels like it doesn't fit for some reason. And it's not that I agree with all the other picks. It's just that this feels wrong and,
and
I'm sort of addressing, yes, adding this as a corrective, if you will.
All right. Well, then let's start with the best new artist category. Who are you excited about in this category and who can you get rid of and replace him with?
Yeah, well, the artists that seem to make a lot of sense to me, Olivia Rodrigo, who obviously had just a meteoric rise from Disney Channel fame to like the pop culture sphere at large. Arlo Parks, this sort of funky singer-songwriter who has been buzzing a little bit over the past few years and really took off last year. And then Japanese Breakfast, who not only had a really great album released last year, but a really great best-selling memoir. But the one that really stood out to me as feeling weird was Phineas. People may know him as the producer slash brother of the pop phenom Billie Eilish. It feels like he is here strictly because he is Billie Eilish's brother. He released a project last year, didn't really seem to move the needle one way or the other, and the music wasn't even that interesting.
Do you think it's so the camera can pan to Billie Eilish in the audience?
100%. Okay.
So if that's the case, and we're getting rid of Phineas, Billie Eilish's brother, who are we replacing him with?
Yeah, I would replace Phineas with this poet, singer, songwriter, Mustafa, from Toronto. Drake endorsed. He has been an activist on the local Toronto scene for a long time. And last year, he released a really gorgeous album, When Smoke Rises, that he describes as inner city folk music. A lot of sort of soft guitars, but there is also light rap drums. And he sings sort of about the struggles of his community in this really intimate, sensitive way that sort of speaks to his poetry background.
Right. Not long ago, you wrote a piece for NewYorker.com about Mustafa's debut album, When Smoke Rises. And you said this, as Mustafa notes on Ali, words can't stop bullets. And as the limitations of his chosen medium set in, he is beset by some truly tormenting revelations. Let's listen to the song, Ali.
Ali, you know our hearts are at their fullest. Ali,
there were no words. Tell us a little bit about what's going on here lyrically and in terms of his story.
Yeah, so Mustafa has been at the center of the Toronto music and poetry scenes since he was 12 years old. He has seen and experienced a lot of violence firsthand, And so his poetry has always reflected the environment that he grew up in, sort of connecting with those that he sees on the day-to-day, not sort of looking out to his city and saying, hey, here's what's going on inside the city, but connecting directly with his peers and being like, please, can we find some sort of resolution to this issue that is plaguing us? You should have left your home. I told you to go. I told you it wouldn't be safe. I told you it wasn't the way. You should have left your home.
Now, Sheldon, the next category is a big one. It's Song of the Year. And there's a lot of heavy hitters out there. You've got Alicia Keys, Billie Eilish, Lil Nas X, to name a few. Which song do you think needs to be, you know, kind of trimmed or replaced for Song of the Year?
Yeah, the song that I would pull is Ed Sheeran's Bad Habits. It feels harsh to come at Ed this way. I don't even think this is necessarily the worst song. One thing I will say about the Grammys is generally they'll be like, if you were to pick out 10 songs and say these songs in some way tell the story of the year in music prior, I think that is a more accurate representation of what the Grammys do in modern times. But with that said, the Ed Sheeran song just doesn't feel like it fits into that landscape.
All right. Well, so Ed Sheeran is feeling some pain now. Who are you slipping in? In his place,
I'm replacing Ed Sheeran with Wizkid and Tems's Essence.
Like that. It's so great. But what can you tell us about Wizkid, and why do you think the song Essence should have been nominated?
Yeah, Wizkid has sort of been at the forefront of the African pop movement, and bridging the gap between African pop and the pop music of America. And Essence was just such a massive breakthrough moment, really resonated with American audiences in a way that African pop hadn't previously, was a top 10 charted single. It just feels like a major omission to keep it off this list when it played such a critical role in the music of the last year.
All right, now, so for Album of the Year, our third category, who do you think will win Album of the Year and why? Who will win?
If I were to pick a winner, I would expect Olivia Rodrigo Sour to pull it out. Just such a zeitgeist moment in music, and most people sort of pointed to her as the next Taylor Swift, which is ironic that Taylor Swift is also nominated in this category.
So does that mean you're bumping her out of the list and you're going to come up with somebody new?
No, the person that I'm going to bump is her back of my mind. This is the third time she's been nominated for Album of the Year, with almost no cultural footprint to speak of. I'm going I wrote about the album. The album is perfectly fine. I just don't think it's reflective of this Grammy mindset where it's like, here we are honoring the people in music that people know. It's like you've got Justin Bieber, you've got Doja Cat, you've got Billie Eilish, you've got Lil Nas X, you've got Taylor Swift, you've got Kanye West, and you've got her. One of those things is not like the others.
I
would replace that album with Jasmine Sullivan's Hotels. Similar type artist, similar type album, far more ambitious. Far more representative of the last year, really resonated with critics, resonated with listeners also in a way that back of my mind has not. And so it's like, if you have the opportunity.
But this is an especially cold move you're pulling here, because Jasmine Sullivan and her are musical collaborators.
Yes, her is featured on the Jasmine Sullivan album, in fact.
Ooh, ouch, ouch. So what do you want to hear from the album Hotels by Jasmine Sullivan? What song are you recommending here most?
Pick Up Your Feelings.
Let's listen.
You said that I've been acting different, yeah. Funny how I finally flipped the script on ya. When you the one who's double dipping, yeah. You so sloppy how I caught you slipping, You're off the lease. Run me my keys. No more popping up the idiot. I ain't even got the miles to trip on ya. No phone.
Who is this?
Brand new. Like the whip. Rack it up. No assist.
Someone's been caught double dipping. It's an infidelity song.
Yeah. Yes. And that is actually reflective of a lot of this record. A lot of it is about perspectives of womanhood, dealing with cheating guys, guys who aren't worth the time that women are putting into them.
There's a new theme.
who aren't holding up their end of the bargain. But at every point, she's sort of looking to friends and other artists for their specific perspectives on this tried and true topic. And she really ends up getting this panoramic view of an old hat theme.
Don't leave no pieces.
Thanks so much, Sheldon.
Thank you too, David.
But you had your fun, but I had enough. Now I'm really done. I deserve so much more than you gave to me. So now I'm saving me, and I made a peace. So you can run them streets. But don't forget to come and pick up your feet.
The New Yorker's Sheldon Pierce. We heard music from Mustafa off his album When Smoke Rises, Essence by Wizkid featuring Thames, Jasmine Sullivan's Pick Up Your Feelings off the album Hotels. And you can read Sheldon Pierce on pop and rap and rock and jazz and more at newyorker.com. He always brings new insights to artists you know, and he'll introduce you to a whole lot of artists you don't. That's the New Yorker Radio Hour for today. Thanks for joining us. I'm David Remnick. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Ave Carrillo, Rita Green, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Gofen Mputubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Allison McAdam and Meng-Fei Chen, and guidance from Emily Botine. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.